Welcome to Tech San Diego Spotlight Contest. I'm Kevin Carroll, Executive Director of Tech San Diego. You can go to techsandiego.org to find out more about Tech San Diego. I've been looking forward to this podcast for quite a while. We have seen a lot of information lately on the news about ransomware, what it does, who does it do it to, the money paid, and I wanted to dive in a little bit. So that's what this podcast is going to be. I'm not the domain expert on this, so I am going to welcome Tony Anscombe to the podcast. Tony, welcome.
Hi, Kevin. Good to be here.
So ESETS, our North American headquarters, of course, is here in San Diego, so we've grown to know them a little bit. Tony is a global security evangelist. He has over 20 years of security industry experience. Anscombe is an established author, blogger, and speaker on the current threat landscape, security technologies and products, data protection, privacy, trust, and internet safety. So we are going to dive right into this. Tony, I read a blog post that you did that was really talking about ransomware, and I think the title was To Pay or Not to Pay. Tell us a little bit about what kind of drove you putting this down on a short white paper and how ESET views the kind of the ransomware landscape, and give us a little bit of a background on that.
You may have noticed, Kevin, a change over the last couple of years that is very apparent. Firstly, there is more targeted ransomware. So what we're seeing is big companies being targeted and paying large sums of money. If we go back a couple of years, you may remember the city of Atlanta got targeted for just $51,000, and now you're seeing companies paying tens of millions of dollars. So it's kind of what happened in that middle piece. And that targeting means the method of attack, which I'm sure we'll get into, has significantly changed too. So this is no longer a shoot everything you see type scenario by the cyber criminals. It's a sniper rifle and picking off their targets very carefully.
Yeah, you know, you kind of look back nostalgically at the good old days when that $50,000 would seem to be welcome in today's environment, where it's in the millions and millions. And I think one of the difference, Tony, and we have talked about this before, is, you know, why are so many victims paying those ransomware demands?
Well, I think there's several reasons, but my own take on this is, if we go back to that Atlanta attack, so roughly around the time of 2018, 2017. If you look at 2018, when the city of Atlanta suffered that attack against their smart city servers, they were asked to pay $51,000 by the cyber attacker. Now, if you fast forward about 12 months, 18 months after that attack, now one thing that's interesting is, when a public body gets attacked in this way, they typically disclose how much the attack cost them. So a post-mortem type scenario. Now, the number I've heard, numbers from 11 million to 17 million. However, I sat at DEF CON last week, and there was a lady there who was actually responsible for cybersecurity in the city of Atlanta at the time. And she said the current number is, it cost the city of Atlanta $22 million to rebuild their systems. So now imagine you're sitting in your boardroom and there's a ransomware attack on your company, and you look back at incidents, for example, like the city of Atlanta, or there are other great ones to look back at. The National Health Service in the UK reportedly cost them $120 million to rebuild their systems. Do you pay or do you not pay? Now, minimum disruption to your business would be paying, getting the decryptor, and getting your business operational. That's, of course, if the cyber criminal does actually provide you the decryptor after you've paid.
That's a very good point. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but you know, you cited in your blog post, you cited a report that said almost half of the businesses that paid ransoms didn't regain access. And I think furthermore in your blog post, those companies that paid got hit again. Is that right?
Yes, a lot of companies pay and then don't get actually the decryptor, or the decryptor is in fact slower than restoring from a backup, which I think was the case in the Colonial Pipeline attack. I actually think they reverted to a slow restore off of their own systems because the actual decryption tool was too slow. So it doesn't always mean that you're going to get uh, the your system's back up and running. The other part that's changed in those couple of years is when that attack happened on Atlanta, it was what I'd define as a traditional traditional ransomware attack. You know, they encrypted the data. They offered to decrypt. Now, cyber criminals get into the network, steal the data, take a copy of it, and then they encrypt. So then it becomes not only about decryption, it becomes about, well, we're going to publish this data on the dark web. So it's as much about of a data breach as it is as stopping somebody accessing their own data.
You know, the other thing that you did, Tony, and I haven't seen anyone do this, is you really called out the middlemen here, right? You really put a stake in the ground saying, you know, these good guys, maybe not so much, right? So you know, you get your ransomware and some guy rides in on a shining horse saying, hey, I'll help you guys, I'll negotiate. Tell us a little bit about these middlemen and maybe why they're not the good guys we think they are.
Well, we've got several middlemen in there, haven't we? One is companies have started taking cyber risk insurance and the insurers are now paying out. So, you know, put yourself back in that boardroom, a ransomware attack happens, and the cyber security team are going, it's okay, we're insured, it's not going to cost us anything, or it's only going to cost us 10% of the premium, or this is our deductible. That changed the decision around the board table on whether to pay or not. And I'm not sure cyber risk insurance should be a substitute for making sure that you don't get don't get attacked and having the right processes and procedures in place so you don't have to pay. But then as part of this is where you've got these middlemen, these companies that have started who are professional negotiators who will come in and turn and say, well, we'll deal with the people on the dark web for you and we'll negotiate the fee and we'll negotiate the deletion of the data should you actually agree to pay. And it's like, hang on a minute, you're making money off of crime and you're negotiating with criminals. And, I'm actually, as you know, Kevin, I'm a Brit. And back in 1987, I think it was, Margaret Thatcher famously said, if you negotiate with terrorists, you get more terrorism. Well, let me tell you, if you negotiate with ransom cyber criminals, you're going to get more cyber crime. I mean, it's easy logic, isn't it?
You would think that would be the case. And, you know, I know you also make the point that there should be legislation. Look, and it's easy for me to say not to pay. I'm sitting here in my remote location of Tech San Diego in technology's perfect climate. But, you know, I think you're right. I mean, if you're sitting in a boardroom and the minimum amount of disruption is to pay, you know, $200,000, $250,000, $500,000, and you think you're going to get back up and running, then it seems to be an easy decision. But you're right. It just propels more and more cyber crime. And you reference that maybe our legislators should be looking to make it more difficult for companies to pay.
Yes. I mean, there should be some mandated method of one, reporting that you have a cybercrime incident of this nature and that you're being, it's extortion. And then depending on the circumstances, it should be some form of joint decision, a collaborative decision between the company and law enforcement on whether there's a need to pay. And actually, let's come back to who does pay, Kevin, just for one moment. If a company you are a customer of has the unfortunate incident of a cyber attack in this method, is it the company paying or is it you as the customer? Because actually the company is there to make a profit. This money doesn't appear on trees. Now, if you can argue, well, they're insured. Yes, but who was it that was paying the insurance policy? And these premiums for these insurance policies are not low cost. It's you, the customer. You're the customer. At the end of the day, you are paying that ransom, not the company.
Absolutely, Tony. That's a really good point. There's a lot of people that are being hurt in this. You also, which was interesting, and I want to make sure we have time to talk about how we may avoid some of this, but just kind of the background of the actors who did it. I've also seen a phrase, and you've coined it also in your blog post. By the way, I keep on talking about blog posts on security. I always go to ESET.com to look up their latest white papers. I would advise listeners go there and look it up. Tony posts his stuff there, in addition to his social media. But that's usually my first stop. Is every once in a while, I'll just hit at the ESET website and take a look. But you've turned the coined the term ransomware as a service. So the people that are doing the attack aren't necessarily the people that are organizing the payment and all that. Talk a little bit about that.
Basically, you have these cybercrime groups that have created the back-end infrastructure and the malware that's used to as the encryptor, so the ransomware itself. So now imagine you're Kevin, and you decide that Tech San Diego is no longer a good place to be, and you decide you want to launch your own ransomware. Well, maybe you can sign up for an affiliate with one of these ransomware as a service groups. And you do the initial piece. So you're the person that gets into the company. You're the person that gets access. What they do is they provide you the tools and the back-end infrastructure. So, the exfiltration of data, somewhere to store it. They provide you the encryption mechanism, and they provide you the ransomware mechanism to actually get you into this. So you can see that what that causes is, in effect, you're outsourcing probably what I define as maybe the difficult piece. However, also getting into the company is probably the difficult piece as well. So this is an affiliate model. It's a reselling model. Now, we often hear that these cybercrime groups are located in country X or country Y. Yeah, the ransomware as a service groups may well be. But where's that middleman located? We very, very rarely hear about where that person is located. And I think those affiliates, those people in the middle, have a lot more local knowledge than we think of as well, because they know who to attack and they know their weak spots, they know the data they've got and which is sensitive. So I think there's a little bit more localization there.
Yeah, it's interesting. You hear about the Russian hacking groups and you assume that, they're all in buildings in Russia, but I think you're right. I think there is local information on the data and what data is important. So most of the listeners of this podcast are small, mid-sized companies, right? If you're a large company, I think you have some resources. So let me shift a little bit and talk a little bit about what's the most common access point for a small, medium-sized business where to get caught up in this ransomware, and what should they do both pre-attack and then post-attack?
Well, so let's talk about pre-attack first. I mean, there are certainly some things that all companies should be doing. One is to have a good backup and recovery system, and that should be both online and offline. And I say that because a lot of companies now have moved to real-time online backups and they go off into the cloud. That's great. But if the ransomware, if the cyber criminal is in your network, they know that you're backing up into a cloud, and they're just going to destroy that backup on their way of conducting their crime. So make sure you've got that, what I define as a traditional backup, Kevin. You remember the guy in a van that you give the tapes to outside the office? Have the traditional backup that's disconnected as well. I mean, not quite the guy in the van with the tapes, but I'm sure your listeners will understand what I mean. Also have good training in place. What we do know is that a lot of cyber attacks or the incursion into a network starts with phishing, credential theft, and unfortunately has a human element. So make sure that you're training your employees what to look out for in phishing attacks. And if somebody doesn't get quite what a phishing attack is, or they have become a victim of a phishing attack in a company, this isn't something they should be punished for. They should be able to go to the cybersecurity team in a company, and actually they should be, somebody should shake their hand for coming forward. If they're asking questions or they think they've done something wrong, they should, it's not a bad thing if they're coming forward. But make sure that the patching is happening as well. We often see those points on machines, don't we? I need, my phone needs to update, my laptop needs to update. Make sure software is up and running and it's up to the latest versions, because that helps patch known vulnerabilities. And good cyber, that general good cyber hygiene. What I'd recommend is to any company, small or large, actually you download the cybersecurity framework from somebody like NIST. Treat it as an evolving checklist, where you're going down there and you're following a process. So you're going to tick off that you've done the backup recovery. You're going to tick off you've done the cybersecurity awareness training, that you've got endpoint security and the endpoint security is up to date, that you've got two-factor authentication in place, etc. and make sure you're following a framework so you don't leave any back door open by mistake.
Yeah, and you know, years ago, I participated in one of the regional workshops on creating that that cybersecurity framework, and I can remember sitting up at UCSD here, kind of involved in some of those the discussions. And then, of course, you know, it's happened. You've got your notice. We have your data. You're going to pay us $100,000. What do you do besides? Let's assume you may not have cyber risk insurance.
Well, you switch off and come back on Monday and hope it's all gone away. No, on a more serious
that's
note.
That's great advice.
On a more serious note, firstly, you go to the fridge and get the beer out. But you need to take stock. So firstly, you need to understand, you know, what's this? Firstly, you need to disconnect the infected systems. So not everything may have been captured by the cyber criminal. So isolate what it is that's been affected. Get a specialized computer security forensics team in. They will help you identify what it is that's been affected and help you isolate it. They'll also help you with recovery. So if you've got a backup and recovery system of actually removing the malware, removing the what's encrypted and recovering your systems. From a legal perspective, you may need a separate forensics team. Yeah. With your legal team. And the reason being is what that forensics team finds for the legal team might need not to be within the company, i.e. it might need to have been a privileged conversation. So you may need two forensics teams. But to start that recovery is then actually you've got to sit down and work out whether you have a backup that is suitable for recovery. You know, have you got the processes in place for actually recovering the data, and understanding what data it is that the cyber criminal may actually have exfiltrated to the dark web as well, because you may need to make a data breach notice to here in California to the state attorney general. So have a crisis plan in place.
And I think, Tony, I think a lot of those tries, if you looked at the cybersecurity framework, a lot of the things that you're referencing are probably in there as well. Would that be correct?
They absolutely are. But actually have run this scenario. Don't wait for it to happen. Actually run a test scenario that, you know, have your IT and security team in on a Friday afternoon one day and actually have a scenario where, you know, ransomware hits on that Friday afternoon and see how quickly you could potentially recover and that you can recover. Practice makes perfect.
Tony, that's really good advice. And I think a lot of companies, obviously, if there's no fire to fight, they're not fighting fires. And so, you know, waiting until that happens is not a good way to proceed. Any other advice and guidance? We're coming up around 30 minutes or so. Any other advice and guidance to listeners about how not to be duped on some of this?
Well, some of the simplest things, you know, that employee education, making sure that employees are aware of what cyber attacks are and that cybersecurity awareness training. Two-factor authentication. I can't say this enough. Yeah, make sure that everything you possibly can put two-factor authentication on, you do. So that you lock out the credentials, you know, you're no longer relying on passwords that we all know people reuse over and over again. Unfortunately, however many times we say don't, people do. So that two-factor authentication stops that. And that's one of the simplest things to actually deploy. But also treat, you know, my biggest thing here is don't wait to be the victim. I recently went and saw an educational establishment here in the Bay Area where I am, and that educational establishment was somewhat shocked that they should even be thinking about this. And it's like, come on, you know, you have lockdown procedures and you practice fire drills. You practice your cybersecurity drills as much as anything else, because a cybercrime coming into virtually any business in today's environment, there are very few businesses that wouldn't actually cease to operate.
Really good advice, Tony. Hey, before we leave here, tell us a little bit about your employer, ESET.
ESET's a longstanding cybersecurity company. We've been in the business for 30 plus years. As you said, we're headquartered in North America in San Diego, and we provide What a lot of people will understand traditionally as antivirus software, we provide that from a consumer level, so an endpoint security product, all the way through to an enterprise solution where it's logging security data and can actually look for anomalies in traffic, etc., and prioritize what a cybersecurity team may actually need to be looking at and how they see interesting attacks coming through. So all the way from threat intelligence all the way down to, you know, my mum on her phone and her laptop.
Well, that's good. And I'm certainly very familiar with ESET going back to the old Nod 32 days. So I've been running ESET for a long time. I don't rely on just Microsoft Essentials. So go to ESET.com and we can get you set up on that. We'll go ahead and end this podcast. Tony, I know you're a real busy guy. So I want to thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to come on the Tech San Diego podcast. We'll put some notes in the podcast about ESET and yourself. Anything else you want to pitch while you're here? Your Twitter handle, your other blogs, anything else?
Well, we ourselves have a weekly podcast called Speakeasy, so you can come and look that one up. But we also have a great blog site for a lot of our research and interesting content is published on welivesecurity.com. And I'd strongly recommend subscribing to that just to keep up to date of what's happening in the cybersecurity world.
All right, that's good. WeLiveSecurity.com. Very good. All right, Tony, we'll keep in touch, and we will see you soon. Hopefully, we won't be contacting you about any Tech San Diego ransomware.
Well, I certainly hope so, too. And maybe one day somebody's going to have a conversation with me that's not about the bad side of life. I sometimes feel like an insurance salesman.
All right, Tony, thanks.
Thanks, Kevin.
Since 1994, Tech San Diego has provided a unifying voice for San Diego's technology community, fostering growth and business acceleration through collaborations between industry, education, and government. We support members from all sectors of the technology industry, including cybersecurity, big data, robotics, SaaS, biotech, healthcare, Internet of Things, defense, telecom, and more. Learn more about us at www.techsandiego.org. Tech San Diego would like to thank ESET's Tony Anscombe for taking the time to join us today. ESET is a member of Tech San Diego and assists us on a number of cybersecurity-focused events. Listen to Tony and co-host Ranson Burkett on their podcast, Speakeasy Security, wherever you listen to podcasts. Producers for Tech San Diego Spotlight are Kevin Carroll and Sarah Spiva. Tech San Diego Spotlight is recorded remotely and edited by Hypable Impact. If you enjoyed this podcast episode, make sure to like, follow, and share.